This podcast is being recorded on Ngunnawal and Ngambri land. We pay our respects to traditional owners of this country and elders past and present. We extend our respects to any First Nations, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people joining us today. The Honourable Justice Janine Pritchard was appointed to the Supreme Court of Western Australia in 2010, appointed as a judge of the District Court of Appeal in 2018, and in 2019 her honour commenced as the President of the State Administrative Tribunal. As a law student who has always been intrigued and at times even confused by, as Her Honour describes it, the mystique of judges and who they are, I was so grateful to meet Judge and to trace her journey from here at the ANU, completing a Bachelor of Law and Bachelor of Arts in the beginning of her legal career to where she is now. Judge and I discuss everything from her experience as a law student to her life in chambers, her thoughts on judicial bias and women in law, and finally her advice to current law students. So I hope you enjoy this wonderfully candid and insightful discussion as much as I did. I guess my first questions are kind of about you and your law school experience. So like, why did you decide to study law?
I was saying to some students this morning that, and I think the experience is still pretty common these days, if you're a student who does reasonably well at school, people sort of tend to assume that you'll gravitate towards one of two kinds of career paths. And so I got asked, are you going to do law or medicine? Yeah. And I didn't think I wanted to be a doctor. I think my bedside manner would be pretty crap. So I said I'll probably do law. And I suppose in addition to that, I'd always been good at being outspoken, perhaps more so than being a public speaker per se, and I did some mock trials and stuff at school and enjoyed those. So I had a bit of an idea that I'd like to do something involved advocacy, I think.
And then once you started law, what kind of law student were you?
I think I was a pretty conscientious law student. I was a conscientious student, full stop, I suppose. So I studied pretty hard. I worked as well, though, held down jobs like everybody has to. And I loved the study of law. I loved my ANU experience. I thought it was just fantastic.
Did you always know that you wanted to be a lawyer, or was there a point that you realised that law would be for you moving forward?
I think once I started law school, I definitely realised that I liked the law. Something, I suspect, to do with the logical thinking of it, making sense of, you know, rules about how our society works. And I think even if you don't end up practising as a lawyer, once you've studied law, you look at the world in a different way, which is a really useful way to look at it. It's a kind of a body of knowledge that's a mystery to everybody who hasn't done it. And it's a huge advantage in how you survive in the world, in day-to-day living. But, yeah, just sort of, I guess it felt right for me, and so I kept on with it.
And then how did you become a judge from that? Like, was it always something that was in your mind, or did you have a career that kind of just landed you into this position?
Well, it's interesting. A few people have asked me about, did you always want to be a judge? And my answer to them has been, well, of course not, because it's not possible, other than for the magistracy, it's not possible in any jurisdiction in Australia to set your path towards a career that will culminate in being a judge in any deliberate fashion. And the reason for that is that you can't these days apply for a job as a judge and think, well, I've met the selection criteria and I think I have the right temperament, so therefore I stand a good chance of being selected. And that's because the selection process for judges does not proceed on that basis. Typically, selection processes have been clothed in mystery, that the executive government taps someone on the shoulder, and that's what happened to me. I'll come back to that in a minute. They tap someone on the shoulder who they think will be an ideal judge, and that's because they've been practising for a long time at the top of their particular field within the law, and that they think they have the right temperament and skills to be a good judge. These days there have been some more recent developments in trying to change the process by which people's names become are put forward as suitable for judicial appointment. And that can usually be done by having a selection panel who might just identify people who'd be suitable. The more advanced approach is to have expressions of interest invited so that people can come forward. And that would be a process where you could actually then start to think, oh, at the end of my sort of career path somewhere, I'd like to be on the bench, and there might be a way to do it. The magistracy is a bit different because in lots of states, and certainly in Western Australia, magistrates' jobs are advertised, you apply for them, a selection panel decides if you meet the criteria, and your name gets put forward to the attorney to cabinet for appointment. And the same with tribunal jobs, but not for the judiciary at the higher levels, district court, Supreme Court and above.
Yeah, I think the logical part of my brain as a law student wants to envision that there's a straight journey there, like associate, something, something.
No. And I think the really important thing for students to bear in mind is that as there's a greater inclination to have a more diverse judiciary, there's more willingness to look beyond the straight confines of the bar. So historically, it would be unthinkable for anyone other than a barrister to be appointed to most positions in the judiciary. So typically, you'd start out your career, perhaps you'd work as a solicitor, you'd go to the bar fairly early, you'd practice at the bar for, 20 plus years, you'd probably be silk by the end, and then after a period of time, then you'd be asked to go to the bench and, you'd join all your other chap colleagues at the bench, right? But these days, because we're looking to have other people on the bench who represent different facets of our community, whether it's in gender or race or otherwise, we have to look further afield because the bar is not necessarily full of a good representative sample of the community. So as a result, we're looking to solicitors in private practice, academics, and other places where there might be great lawyers who'd be ideal judges. But it's a slow kind of a process to get there. So in WA, certainly on the Supreme Court, we've got several practitioners who were solicitors. They weren't really advocates and they've been appointed to the bench. There are also other ways now that we're seeing a little bit more of, which is that people get appointed to a lower court and then might get sort of promotional positions. So you might start as a registrar and find yourself up as a judge in the end, or be perhaps a judge in one lower court and then get appointed to a more senior court. And that happened to me. So I started as a district court judge and a deputy president of the State Administrative Tribunal, and then I was appointed to the Supreme Court and then to the Court of Appeal. So there's a little bit of scope for that, I think, as well.
Could you spell out a little bit more the movements you made to become a judge and how your mindset might have developed or how you might have come to terms with the way your career was progressing?
So I don't know if it was any particularly deliberate kind of approach, but more an organic kind of just development of it. But I was very lucky in a couple of respects. So the first was that I moved to Western Australia from the ANU, and I hadn't finished my law degree. I needed to finish the final year of my law degree, and I came across this scheme in Western Australia, which was within the State Solicitor's Office. They would look for students who hadn't finished their law degree but were in the last year that they could do part-time. And they would get them to work with the most senior members of the State Solicitor's Office, so the Solicitor General, the State Council, the State Solicitor. And the idea was to attract really smart ones who had great potential and get them to work with the people in the sort of the upper echelons of the office and to see what kind of law there might be and to encourage them to join the office in the longer term. So I got one of those positions, and I was very lucky to work for the Solicitor General, Kevin Parker, for a couple of years, which was just incredible because he was doing high court litigation, he was advising government at the highest levels, and it just opened my eyes to a whole world of practice that I had never really considered. I mean, it just wouldn't have occurred to me. And I think in part that was because the sorts of career opportunities you might get exposed to at law school, apart from seeing things on telly, which is the old commercial sort of stuff, suits. It wasn't suits, it was LA Law in my day. It tends to be more commercial sort of focus. I think ANU, I've noticed in the last couple of days as I've been talking to students, there seems a lot more awareness of some other opportunities, whether it's community law or working in government in policy or working for the parliament in different research roles or what have you. But I guess if you'd asked me at law school what I would do, I would have thought that I'd go to a commercial firm probably and, you know, work as a solicitor. Mm. So to fall into the opportunity, find the opportunity in my lap of working for the Solicitor General was incredible. Mm. So then after that, I stayed with the State Solicitor's Office and I did articles, which you did back in those days. And then I just kind of started legal practice and I did work as a solicitor and then as a counsel doing, you know, arguing matters in court and so on. And I did that for a long time, which is traditionally what you do in a kind of a career path that might lead to the bench, which is you're going to practice at a high level and I guess emerge at the end of that kind of period. And for me, it was about 17 years or so, having experience and recognised ability that is seen to make you suitable for appointment. And along the way, one other thing that I did, which was that I wanted to advance my judicial, my legal education. Mm. And so I did a master's overseas. Mm. I took a year off work, used my long service leave, saved up, and went overseas and did that, which was a fantastic experience for just getting some perspective on the law in Australia and meeting other people and seeing how their judicial, their legal background sort of were informing the work that they did. So that was really great too.
Yeah. What do you think are some of the cultural and day-to-day differences of chambers and the court system in WA compared to other jurisdictions like the ACT, New South Wales?
Well, it's hard for me to tell because I only know what I know. So I think that's a bit hard to say. I suspect it's remarkably similar, really. There are some common features of life in the judiciary at the sort of superior court level, and that is pretty high workload, similar sorts of work being done. Whether you're doing criminal work or civil work or a combination of both, it's the similar sort of stuff everywhere, and similar experiences, I think, in the sense that quite a lot of the work of a judge is solitary work. You get given a case to determine, you hear the case, you write your reasons, if you're giving written reasons or you deliver oral reasons, whatever it is, it's your work on your own, unassisted really by anybody else except the counsel who appeared. So it's not that sort of collegiate environment that you might have in a law office in the sense of working with others to get an outcome. You're surrounded by others in chambers, but the only people that probably have much day-to-day contact with in talking about cases, and even then it's about the administrative conduct of the case, are your associates. I'm just going to give a plug here for law students listening that if you want to think about something to do in your career that gives you great opportunities and insight into how the law works and it exposes you to heaps of different kinds of advocacy, it's being a judge's associate. And if you haven't given it thought, then all of you should because just the opportunity to see things and to see what a judge thinks about, you know, the advocacy, the style of advocacy, the strength of the case, the merits of competing arguments, just invaluable for younger practitioners.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear that a lot of the work that you do is solitary work, but it makes sense. What are the interactions like that you have with people in chambers? Because this might be a stereotype or something that I've got from media depictions of the courtroom, but I understand that it's quite a prestigious environment to work in and the court system exists in this pinnacle of the law. Mm-hmm. They are how decisions are made and how the law evolves in a way. Does that prestige and formality, does that kind of transcribe into how you interact with people, or does it feel more down to earth and informal, the way you act with your associates and other judges?
Well, I think in the courtroom it has to be fairly formal, although I'm in a tribunal at the moment, so we try to be as informal as we possibly can to make people feel relaxed, especially if they're acting for themselves without representation. But outside chambers, I'd like to think we're very down to earth. Certainly the colleagues that I have presently in the State Administrative Tribunal, it's all really relaxed environment where we're talking about, you know, day-to-day stuff and getting along well, speaking to my associates and getting the work done without any kind of formality at all. So really just the formality, I suppose, is safe at the hearing room because it's a serious business. Whether it's a small case or a big case, the case is going to be important to the litigants involved and they deserve to have it dealt with seriously. Mm. So that's the need for the formality there. But as to how people treat judges, I don't let anybody know I'm a judge for a couple of reasons. One is security and safety, because sometimes people are unhappy with your decisions and, you know, there's nothing worse than people seeing you in the street or something and being unhappy with the decision and having to have some sort of confrontation about it. So the less sort of high profile you are, I think, the better. But the other reason is that I think perhaps it's because of what you've described as the prestige, but I would tend to say maybe more the mystique of the judiciary. People often treat you in a slightly odd fashion. And by odd, I mean, I guess they either put you on a pinnacle or think that you should be treated in a special fashion, which is the last thing I want, because I don't, when I'm in the community just going about my day-to-day business, I'm just me. I'm not a judge there. That's outside of my workplace, if you know what I mean. So the last thing I want is for people to know and therefore treat me differently.
Yeah, it's like being a psychiatrist and not wanting to tell other people because
I'll think
they're analysing
them. That's right.
I also think it's interesting that you say that formality is important in the courtroom, because it's, I think it's almost like you're showing respect to the people who have brought their matters into that space. And, the importance of giving time and space to hear those matters. And I think that's really interesting, because something that I've observed about the courtroom is that there's a lot of talk of respect, and I haven't thought of it before about showing respect to the people bringing their cases forward. I've only heard it in the sense of showing respect to the judge, which I understand, but I think I also felt like that was quite one-sided and something that I've, just questioned in the past. But I think that makes sense, that these are places where really serious matters are deliberated and decided, and so respect is about giving the time of day.
Yeah, and it's connected as well with a fair hearing. So if you treat the proceedings like they're a joke, I mean, there have been some discussions occasionally in academic literature about humour in a courtroom. And I think the general wisdom is that humour is a bad idea because you don't want to give people the impression that you're not taking this seriously. That's one of the problems. Another issue that you need to bear in mind is if you have a degree of formality, then nobody gets the impression that one side is being treated more favourably than the other side. So to give you an example, if you were appearing in a hearing and the counsel on the other side, if there was a counsel, was being called by their first name, you as a self-represented litigant would be immediately thinking, well, hang on a minute, what's going on here? The judge and the counsel on the other side of, know each other, and there's some sort of, sort of relationship or some sort of friendship or something's going on there. You would immediately feel like the proceeding wasn't being conducted in a fair fashion. So I think that formality transmits messages that reassure people about the fairness of the hearing that's underway.
So if you think about it that way, what's the difference? I understand it in my head, but how do we spell out the difference between needing to reserve a sense of formality in the courtroom but needing to make people feel comfortable when you move into a tribunal?
Well, the sense of formality can be, I guess it's still achieved, but in a way which can make people feel a bit more relaxed. There's a number of ways to do that. So the more you have of the standing up and sitting down at certain times and saying things that people don't necessarily understand, use of Latin or legally sort of colloquial terms, that sort of stuff, I think makes people feel like outsiders to the process. So you can have that level of formality, but then it's one that shrouds the whole process in mystery. You can be formal in the sense of, I'm going to call you Ms. So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so, that I'm going to try and listen as best I can and be courteous if I have to interrupt you to clarify something. I'm going to expect you to be courteous to the other people in the room, and we're all going to treat each other with civility. But that doesn't need to be scary and alienating. That can just be, here's some ground rules for respect, as you were saying before. And so with that, then the tribunal space, usually required, if not encouraged, by the constituting legislation of the jurisdiction, the Tribunals Act that establishes it, will require the Tribunal to deal with matters informally and speedily and so on. So because of that legislative objective, then you can try some things out to make the process more easily understood, but still with that sort of basic ground rules of the respect and civility that I've been referring to. So, for instance, in the State Administrative Tribunal where I'm from, we've done some work on processes that people can watch videos and stuff beforehand so they can find out what the process is going to look like. And nothing worse than going into a space and not being quite sure of what's happening next.
Yeah.
So you can watch a video. We've got some of our videos, information videos, are overlaid in Aboriginal languages so that people who are from Indigenous backgrounds can watch those and feel not so unsure about what to expect. And we've got easy read sheets for people who've got cognitive difficulties. We've got, you know, other kinds of support services available. And we're having a discussion at the moment about whether we start each of our hearings with words of welcome. We started out talking about whether we should just have an acknowledgement of country, but we're having a general chat about whether we should have a broader set of words of welcome that say to people things like, we welcome into the hearing, everyone is here, everyone who is here is going to be listened to, and we want to make sure that you're heard. If you have experienced trauma and find the proceedings triggering, and they sometimes can be, please let us know if you need a break. We acknowledge any Indigenous members of our community here, and we pay our respect to your elders. So we kind of make people feel at the outset like they're involved and welcome, and that's what we're sort of moving to.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And I think, I guess it's just that there's a difference between formality and accessibility. Also, I wanted to know, what are the limitations of being a judge? It's kind of a weird question, but something that I observe about judges is that there's this need to be impartial. Mm-hmm. And do you find that limiting? And I guess you already said that you don't tell people outside of your work that you're a judge. Do you think there's anything else that's limiting about it?
Absolutely. And the big one that you guys, all you young ones, would notice is social media. It's not universally the case, but most judges would have a very cautious view about having a presence on social media. I have none. And again, that is for a couple of reasons. One is the sort of security issue. But much more importantly, it's about the apprehension of bias, the impartiality issue, avoiding any problems with that. So, I mean, you all know the fair hearing rule, and that one aspect of it is that you have a hearing where people can feel confident that the hearing is a fair one and that there's no apprehension of bias. How would there be an apprehension of bias? Well, if you've made statements about a particular case, that would be the worst of all, but all cases in general of a certain kind beforehand, and they're out there as they always are once you put them on social media, people might well say, well, how are you going to bring an unbiased mind to the hearing so we can have a fair hearing? So there's a general view that you shouldn't be putting stuff out there for those sorts of reasons. Some people take different views about that, but I think it certainly is the most prudent course of action. So that's one of the main things I think that you would notice about a different approach.
Is it something that you've had to come to terms with? Like, also, I know, you don't have to speak to this, but you studied a diploma of women's studies, and I would imagine there would be aspects of activism, advocacy, and some might say some radical ideas that would come through that study. Do you ever feel like you're limited in speaking about those ideas, given your role as a judge?
So, again, speaking about things that might have might attach controversy to them, I probably wouldn't put that out there in a public space. But that's partly because I'm entitled to my personal views. I just don't need to put them out there in a way that ultimately might cause a problem for my being able to hear a matter without giving rise to an apprehension of bias on the part of one of the parties. In relation to things like personal views about feminism or the rights of women or equality generally and so on, well, of course I have those views. There are limited, probably, places in which I would see a role for me to express those views in a kind of public, formal kind of way. Yeah. Occasionally I'll give a speech that will have something to do with that. But for the most part, I tend to just keep my views about those sorts of things to myself. Mm. Yeah, there might be a different time in my life when I can say more stuff about that and write papers about that or otherwise, but that's not the space I'm in at the moment, and they're not normally the sorts of matters that trouble me in the course of work. And let me just explain that a little bit more. When you're judging, you're applying the set of rules that are represented by the law as it currently stands to a particular set of facts. If you're a trial judge at the bottom of the hierarchy, there's not a lot of room for movement in the development of the law. Mm. I think people kind of assume sometimes that judges can make the law in all sorts of significant steps and radical ways, you know, that Lord Denning would come along and, you know, all of a sudden there's a new sort of doctrine or something. It's not really very common at all, and would be most unwise to do something like that if you're a trial judge at the bottom of the pile, because if you don't apply well-accepted principles of law, you're just going to get rolled on appeal. Yeah. It's a waste of everyone's time and money, including your own. So you just, if there's any development of the law at all, it's all those little incremental things. The law is applied to this set of facts as opposed to that slightly different set of facts that was, you know, on the books before, sort of thing. And as a result, there's not a lot of cases necessarily where personal views about particular issues, political, gender-based, equality-based, whatever they might be, really kind of come into it in an overt way. Sometimes I think it, in relation to areas where the personal might meet the political, in, there might be opportunity for that. So in the criminal law, the way sexual assault laws work and so on, might be an opportunity where there's the development of law can be more more readily pursued or explored. Family law is another one where, you know, you see sort of human dynamics playing out. But more likely, I think, for judges, it might be that their different experiences, whether their views about things born from education or just life experiences, play out in the way that you hear evidence and receive evidence and understand evidence in a hearing room, where you can appreciate the life experience of a witness, where that might affect how you view their evidence, whether they've appeared to be credible and truthful and so on in their evidence, whether you can understand that their evidence is coherent because it resonates with the life experience that you have. And that's why I think diversity on the bench is really important, because it's that background of life experiences that enriches our understanding of the human experience played out in trials.
Mm. Well, off the back of that question, what do you love most about being a judge?
I think just generally with judging, it's the intellectual challenge of it. In some respects, it's when you have a trial, it's dealing with the pieces of a jigsaw. You know, there are, here's all the facts and there's law over here, and you've got to put it all together in a coherent fashion, and that's intellectually satisfying to do. I think now that I've been a head of jurisdiction, there's been some other aspects that I've enjoyed a lot, and that's a different kind of judging role. Not so much judging, but it's the dealing with the tribunal as I am, and looking at the ways we can do justice better within the tribunal and exploring different kinds of ideas for how we can do that. So I've enjoyed that very much.
Mm. You touched on this idea last week. You were featured on a panel about public law, and you said that good lawyers are generalists. Can you talk more about that idea?
So I guess what I was cautioning against and urging people to think about were two things. Mm. The first is, I think sometimes, the sorts of people who end up coming to law school are super smart usually, probably high achievers, perfectionist seekers, and people who are very likely to have goals. I want to achieve this, and by this age I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do that. And that sometimes can mean that you lose sight of other opportunities that might be available to you. And so I think that kind of specialisation in the form of I've got a path that I want to follow just makes you blind to other possibilities. And that starts at law school, because if you say, oh, I want to be a commercial lawyer, I'm just going to focus on commercial law subjects, then you'll have missed the opportunity to try those electives, which actually might be really interesting, might open up lines of thought about where your career might go, which would be such a shame. But more importantly, in the longer term, I think being a generalist is really great for being a great lawyer. And the reason is, Clients don't come in and go, I've got a contract problem. They come in and say, I've got a problem. And to understand how to solve the problem, you need to work out what the problem is, what legal issues might arise from it, and then obviously to work towards the solution. If you only practice in corporations or you only practice in family law or what have you, to the exclusion of other areas of law, I just don't think you're as well equipped to work out what the legal problem is, much less the solutions. So I think if you can try and be a generalist early on, that really, really helps. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't develop specialties in the sense of you might get expertise in a particular line of cases, or you might decide that you want to be a family law practitioner, say. But I just caution against doing that too early in your career. I think, I think it makes you a better lawyer to be a journalist. The other thing is, if you're going to be a lawyer for a long time, and having invested a large part of your life in getting through law school, I hope you'll be a lawyer for a long time. You'd want to have the opportunity to try some different things. And if you just do one thing, it's going to get a bit boring along the way.
I want to talk about women in the judiciary. You touched on this in your admission speech into the Supreme Court. You said, and I'm going to read this quote, you touch on this idea that regrettably it remains the case that there is something slightly out of the ordinary about the appointment of a woman judge, and in my case, the appointment of a comparatively young woman. In the broader community, it is interesting that it remains something unusual or worthy of comment. And then you share some comments from people in your broad circles who have said things like, girls can't be judges. So from your perspective, what are the key barriers to accepting women in the judiciary, and what are your broader perspectives on the barriers to women in the legal profession?
Well, how we can get more women into the judiciary, I think, is fairly significantly affected by how we select them. And in Western Australia, we've been fortunate, I think, to have had some attorneys general who've been really keen to try and increase the number of women on the bench, particularly, but not exclusively, but particularly going back to Jim McGinty, Christian Porter, and more recently and very significantly, John Quigley. And they have been keen to try to ensure that we have women appointed. But as I was explained to you before, the way we select women or candidates for judicial appointment can really affect who ultimately gets there. The seat. So if you just choose from the bar and the people who choose, say, just for an example, were only middle-aged men from a particular background, they might tend to look for people who look like them. The same might, of course, arise if you picked a group of women who were looking to appoint people. They might only look to looking to reflect themselves, if you know what I mean. So I think we get more women onto the court by thinking about what are our selection criteria, where do we find the people who might have that criteria, and who selects them. So if you have selection criteria which make clear what skills and attributes you want your judges to have, then immediately you aren't just looking for a kind of person, you are looking for a person with particular skills and attributes. If you say we're not just looking for people from the bar, but we're looking for the people throughout the whole of the profession, then immediately you can look beyond the bar where there are still less women than men and therefore less candidates for appointment at the top echelons, the people who are the most talented, the best. And you can look to whether there might be fantastic women solicitors who've got lots of experience that would be relevant to carrying out judicial office. Or you might look to academia and say, wow, that person over there would be a brilliant judge because they know all about this area of law and they've done lots of other things, blah, blah. So it's the skills and attributes, the pool from which you get them, and then it's the process by which they're selected, and you have to think carefully about that. And there's been a lot of, I guess, thinking about this in recent times. There's been discussion at the federal level about whether there should be selection sort of panels. This was an idea floated when Robert McClelland was the attorney and has been revisited now by Mark Dreyfus for courts other than the High Court, whereby the executive attorneys general, for instance, get a selection panel to put names forward, and then there's the executive can choose who to appoint from a list, for instance. So in that selection process, you have to ensure that the people picking are going to be able to look beyond a particular paradigm or particular model of what a judge should look like. And you can do that by thinking about whether maybe you have a representative of the community having some role in that selection process, whether it should only just be judges, because if you have judges, they might only choose the people who look like judges, which might be a certain kind of person.
Yeah.
And so I think if you have some representatives of different areas of the community, it might have to be probably a judge or head of jurisdiction on there, but there might be a community member, there might be someone representing the executive directly, who knows, but the way you select can really affect it. In terms of barriers to women in the profession generally, that's a much bigger question. I think the main and continuing area of difficulty or challenge for women is juggling family responsibilities with work. That's not just a women problem, of course. It's a problem that exists for any person who wants to have a family life, who wants to have children, who wants to care for elderly relatives, who wants to even have just other pursuits, to have a domestic personal sphere which they can maintain while working. And that raises questions for our profession about how we place value on lawyers. Historically, probably up till fairly recently, value was attributed to those who could bill the most. And so that meant that the more time you're at the office, the more hours you could do, the more valuable you necessarily must be, because you could generate the most fees, which is a pretty inefficient and narrow view of what makes a valuable employee. So it's part of breaking down that kind of an approach. It's also, I think, a recognition, and I don't want it to be patronising, but to say you younger ones, but you younger ones do have a different approach to work, which I think is much more sensible. And I really hope it will bring about change through your demand for change in a workplace, which says we want to have reasonable working hours, hours that permit us to have a life outside our work, which will mean that we can be rested and refreshed and energised to do our work more efficiently and more enthusiastically and for a longer period of time and more satisfyingly than those who just jump on the treadmill and do nothing but work for 20 or 30 years and then get booted out of their partnership because they're too old, or just run out of puff because they're too tired. So I think, you know, there's hopefully some input from younger lawyers coming through the system to say, actually, no, let's do things in a slightly different way but still do a fantastic job for clients.
I have to say, I really appreciate how candid and honest you are about some of the limitations that you see about the legal profession. Are these conversations that you have within the judiciary, or are they things you think about outside, or are these conversations that can be had between judges? Do you think lots of other judges think about this, or is this a you?
Look, I think some judges would have the conversations. I'm particularly interested. Now, that could be a combination of my background, my thinking from earlier education, my concerns about the way our society carries on, you know, the way women are treated, the way we treat people with family responsibilities, the way we assist people to balance things out. It's part of my concern about how the judiciary works and whether we take care of our judges and make sure that they can have lives that are fulfilling in all respects, as well as in doing their job as a judge really well. So I certainly have the discussions. I probably bore people senseless with my views on the discussions if given the opportunity. In the hope that that might bring about sort of some change, at least thinking, a discussion is the first place to start. And I know I've got plenty of other colleagues who share my concerns, some to greater or lesser extents.
Okay, just some questions about like more advice-based for current students. So I ask everyone who comes on this podcast for their law school life hack. It's like their life hack, but for law school. So,
oh God, you're asking me to remember something that's 30 years ago.
It can be a piece of advice. It can be something very small and practical, or it can be a broader idea that you would like to pass on.
Yeah, well, looking back now, and I've apologies to anyone who's listening to this who's spoken to me or heard me speak recently, because I've said the same sort of thing. But looking back now, I think the best bit of advice really is to be open to all possibilities. So for me, I went to Western Australia. I didn't really know what might happen there in terms of finding a job. I found a job which was way out of left field, but it turned out to be a fantastic job which set me on a career path that I could not have imagined beforehand. Even going to Western Australia was a kind of a bit of leap of faith, and that was, pretty big gamble, but it really paid off for me in the end. So I think for law students, you know, the world is your oyster. You've got so, I mean, life can be hard. I don't for 1 minute forget that. Mm. I know you've got to make ends meet and pay rent and God knows how you survive if the current financial pressures, but the world is your oyster. You've got smarts, you've got most of you are so full of confidence and you've got opportunities that are just waiting for you. So grab them when they arise.
And do you have any advice to students who would like to be a judge? Mm. If anyone who is managing to think that far ahead, who is inspired by you and what you do?
I would say concentrate on having a good career because the judicial appointment thing at the end is a matter of luck and being in the right place at the right time currently. It might change. But even if it does change in terms of selection, it's going to always require that you have got to the top of your profession because we want our judges to be people who are at the top of the profession so that they can be entrusted with the task of judging and hopefully not buggering it up too often, you know. So there's a public confidence that goes with that. And how do you get to that? Well, unfortunately, the stark reality is you're going to have to work pretty hard. Yeah. Okay, let's hope you can work within some manageable hours and have that work-life balance we've been talking about. But you're still going to have to work pretty hard. You're going to have to apply yourself. And, again, the stark reality of being a good lawyer is there's just no shortcuts. There's no way you can just do it, sidestep the work. And sometimes I think we're seduced into thinking that law is not that. You know, you watch Suits or, you watch any of those legal shows on telly, Lincoln Lawyer or whatever it is my kids love, and they don't seem to do any work. No one's there at 2 in the morning preparing some submission for the next day or slaving over something for weeks and weeks trying to get it right. Mm. That doesn't happen on telly, but it happens every day in law firms, in government offices, in judges' chambers, in community legal centres. Lawyers are doing the hard grind of actually working out what the law is and applying it to their client's case and putting it forward in the forum that they're appearing in or the negotiation they're in or the mediation they're in or whatever.
Mm. Well, they're all my questions. Thank you so much, Judge. I really appreciate all of your responses and, your time today.
My pleasure.
Very grateful.
It's been great. Thanks.
Thank you. That concludes this week's episode of Law and Disorder with the Honourable Justice Janine Pritchard. I would just like to extend another big thank you to Her Honour for sharing her time, and also thank you to Heather Roberts for your assistance in setting up this discussion. Remember, if you have any suggestions for podcast guests, topics or feedback, you can email marketing.law@anu.edu.au and include Law and Disorder in the subject line, or you can do so via Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy this podcast, be sure to rate us 5 stars on those platforms. I'm your host, Audrey Mims, and I'll see you on our next episode of Law and Disorder.